Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the program today, why there is no Ebola vaccine. Here's a hint, you got to follow the money. Why cable companies are taking a stand with content providers. Here's another hint, you got to follow the money. And how Star Wars conquered the universe. Here's another hint, you got to follow the money. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 1st of October. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. The public health infrastructure in the great state of Texas is at full alert today as we learn more details about the first case of Ebola actually diagnosed in the United States. Officials in and around Dallas are tracking down and monitoring the people who might have been exposed to the infected patient. And while the odds of getting it here are still minuscule, Ebola is, as you know, deadly and there is no cure and no vaccine. Why is that? A lot of reasons, of course, but a big one is that until now there hasn't been much incentive for drug makers to make one. From the Health Desk at WHYY Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has more.
Drug manufacturers want to make money. To that end, Columbia economist Frank Lichtenberg says companies want to know two things, the number of potential customers and their ability to pay.
There are a million consumers, and each of them would be willing to pay, for example, $1,000 for a drug. That translates into a $1 billion potential market.
That is in no way the Ebola market.
The total number of cases of Ebola in the world between 1976 and 2013 were less than 2,000.
Dr. Sue Desmond-Hellman is the CEO of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which last month committed $50 million to address Ebola. What the Ebola outbreak reminds us all is that millions of lives are potentially at risk, and there are few incentives for private industry to treat or prevent diseases like Ebola and malaria. Until now, funding vaccines and medicines has fallen to philanthropies, federal governments, and entities like the World Health Organization. Desmond Hellman says the spread of Ebola forces people to ask whether that system is adequate.
This epidemic is showing us how important it is for the world to have at the ready a response for such an epidemic.
The U.S. government has invested millions on Ebola over several decades, but the reality is it can take years and years and billions of dollars to develop effective therapies. So how do you get more money into R&D for these diseases and other public health concerns? USC health economist Joel Hay says, here's one idea that's been kicked around.
If you just add a tax on every pharmaceutical product sold, that money could be used for some of these more, let's say, socially desirable goals.
The thing you have to remember, this is a tricky market to regulate, and it's trickier still for government where they have a duty to keep people safe, but come up with the right incentives to keep the drug industry in the game. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Reddit is, for those who may not know, a digital bulletin board of sorts where gazillions, and I do believe that is the actual number, gazillions of users basically talk about things. There are areas, subreddits technically, for almost any topic you can conceive of and many topics that honestly, you can't. The company has now raised $50 million from a bunch of investors with a plan to give some of that back to the Reddit community. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains.
Reddit is a bit like a baby raised on a commune. You know, it's got its own parents, but lots of outsiders feel like a part of the family. Like Colin Grusing, who's rather gushy about his favorite subreddits on topics like entrepreneurship and wedding planning.
You know, the content is 95% of the time relevant and interesting, which is really cool. I don't know if there's any other site on the internet that does that so well.
Passionate users make the site a good investment for Sam Altman, the president of Y Combinator and the lead investor in this funding round. He says, like other large community sites, Reddit could make money in three ways.
One, obviously, is with ads. Two is with charging users for premium features. And three is with some version of commerce. I'd say these are more in the experimentation phase, but where you let people basically spend money on the site and take part of that transaction.
Altman and his fellow investors want to give 10% of their shares back to the community because users have helped build the site. And also, he says, people treat a car they own better than a rental. Simple idea, but other companies have tried it and failed, says Lance Kimmel, a securities lawyer.
I think Reddit really has their work cut out for themselves. This stuff is really, really complicated.
Reddit has floated the idea of giving users some sort of alternative digital currency backed by shares, which might just be the sort of thing Reddit users would love. But Kimmel doesn't think the Securities and Exchange Commission will feel the same. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Julia Pearson, the director of the Secret Service, resigned today. Resigned in that peculiar way political Washington has of firing somebody without really firing them. Wall Street this Wednesday was not loving the Ebola news, not loving the economic news, just not loving anything at all. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a push on in this country to get more low-income students into college, which makes sense when you think about it. More jobs now require a college degree, and college graduates do better financially over the long run. The push is working. More low-income kids are enrolling in college. It's finishing that can be the problem. From the Education Desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
A year ago, Jan Escobar was working part-time as a bank teller and going to school full-time at Montgomery College in Rockville, Maryland. Then his boss started asking him to work more. Escobar needed the cash and didn't want to jeopardize the job.
When you're in a tight situation with your money, it's hard to say no to extra hours. So I thought I could manage working more hours and being able to make it to class on time and going to school.
It turned out he couldn't.
The way I planned it out, everything had to fall perfectly into place, and that's really not likely at all. So, yeah, it didn't work out.
Escobar ended up dropping a class after the deadline and wound up owing the school almost $500 for credits he never got. He couldn't re-enroll until he'd saved enough to pay off the debt. The whole thing set him back a year.
What you can see is that, you know, a few hundred dollars, $1,000 can really derail a student's success.
Mike Wasserman runs a program in Massachusetts called Bottom Line. It helps low-income students get into college and then make it to graduation. He says colleges will often be flexible about things like an ad drop deadline when an emergency comes up, but students may still have to give back their financial aid.
Often families are using a student's financial aid to keep the family going. And so even though the school says, we'll give you a break, you just need to refund your loans, the money's already spent on rent and things like that.
Sometimes students just lose track of what they owe. A couple of overdue library books, an unexpected charge at the campus health center. Angel White had to take some time off from Western Illinois University to work at Walmart so she could pay off a few hundred dollars she owed the school.
Just little stuff that like added up that I didn't really pay attention to.
Then a financial aid snafu left her owing $1,300 she couldn't pay. When she tried to transfer to a less expensive community college, White says Western Illinois wouldn't release her transcript. That meant she couldn't transfer even the credits she'd paid for. She had to take several classes over again.
The whole experience set me back a lot, seeing as though right now I'd be a senior in college instead of a sophomore. It's a very discouraging process.
Situations like these are one reason low-income students are much more likely to drop out of college than wealthier students. Nancy Leopold is executive director of College Tracks, a college access program in Maryland. She says when you don't have parents who can bail you out or help you navigate the system, small mistakes and emergencies can carry a high price.
What they really lack is the slack that their more affluent counterparts have, that sort of room to maneuver when the unexpected happens.
Many believe colleges aren't doing enough to help those students manage the almost inevitable financial challenges. Marvin Hoffman helps advise disadvantaged students from Chicago with a group called Aim High.
Many colleges now have opened the doors wider to admitting low-income students because they are interested in a more diverse student population, but they haven't addressed the problems of keeping those students in school.
But more colleges are turning their focus to retention. Some schools offer emergency loans or grants. Others have stepped up their advising to help students avoid pitfalls in the first place. Jan Escobar went back to Montgomery College with the help of a mentoring program called FutureLink. His mentor made him a deal. FutureLink would pay half the debt as long as Escobar got more involved with the group.
We're in touch like twice a week, and they always are checking up on me and seeing if I'm keeping up with my work.
So far, he is, he says. He found a job with more flexible hours, working as a host at a restaurant. He's hoping to finish his associate's degree in business administration next year, then transfer to a four-year college. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Intel isn't quite as big a deal, at least publicly, as it was back in the 90s when PC commercials were all over the TV and that little jingle, you know, bum, 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 accompanied all those ads talking about Intel Inside. The company is, however, still deep inside the guts of almost all the technology we use today, not to mention the growing market for what is called the Internet of Things. Computer chips inside refrigerators and cars, vacuum cleaners, you get the picture.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
So today on Conversations from the Corner Office, Brian Krzanich, he is the CEO of Intel, has been since May of last year. Mr. Krzanich, good to have you with us.
It's nice to be here, Kai.
When you think about Intel's place in the digital and electronic world of 2014, I wonder how you feel when you look at Apple and Google and Yahoo and a lot of those companies, and nobody acknowledges Intel's presence, but maybe a lot of it couldn't have happened without you guys. Does that make you a little crazy?
You know, it doesn't actually. It typically makes me kind of proud. For every, I think it's around every 600 cell phones that are sold, we takes another server, and we power most of the servers in the world.
So it's a business opportunity.
Yeah, so I look at all of those things and say, you're right, they're powered, many of them by Intel, they're driven by Moore's Law, and I'm a part of that.
Interesting point about Moore's Law. Obviously, it's the law come up with by Gordon Moore, one of the founders of your company, that basically says computing speed and chip capabilities will double, what, every 18 months, right?
That's right.
You are quite literally at the center of the Moore's Law conundrum, because there has to come a point where you guys can't do what you do faster and better and cheaper and stronger anymore.
Well, you know, I'm the sixth CEO at Intel, and every CEO before me and probably at least a couple after me, I hope, will have to face the issue of, are they going to be the one that Moore's Law stops on their watch?
Yeah.
At least for us, we know we can go, you know, we're at 14 nanometers now. The next node is 10 nanometers.
All right, wait, so speak English. 14 nanometers means what?
14 nanometers is the width of the smallest line on the chip itself.
Wow.
And so we know at least for the next three nodes, so for roughly the next 6 years, how to continue with Moore's Law. And that's about as far as we ever know, is 6 to 10 years. For most of my stint as the CEO, at least, I think we'll be able to keep Moore's Law alive. And beyond that, we'll have to see if we can continue to invent. I have a lot of confidence that we can.
Fingers crossed, huh?
Yeah, well, and there's a lot of work to get the result, but yes.
Yeah. You also have another, what I think you could fairly say is a radical goal that you guys are working on. You want to get everything that you make, every product you make, to be conflict-free by 2016, which is right around the corner.
Yeah, it is. But you know, we made a similarly hard, in fact, in some ways, maybe even harder goal a couple of years ago when we said we would make all our microprocessors conflict-free. Because back then, we didn't know even how to do it, what the process was, or whether it could be done. We've done that. So now saying you're just going to continue it through all the other things, it seems a bit more doable. I think it's just the scope. There's a lot of products. There's a lot of supply chain. But yes, it's a big challenge.
You're going to get there?
Absolutely. I mean, at Intel, we're kind of known for kind of our relentless pursuit and kind of our maniacal process. And so we have literally listed every single thing we make, what the components are inside all of those things. And we have now a fairly long list of everything that needs to become conflict-free. And we are simply mapping its supply chain, knowing where each metal comes from. And yes, we'll get there. But it'll be close.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that you are relentlessly focused on these things. This is a company founded by engineers, built by engineers, run by engineers. You are an engineer. Please don't take this the wrong way, but it almost seems a little joyless that you guys are like, we got to do this. We got to keep going. We got to have Moore's Law. We got to go.
I don't, trust me, I don't take offense of that.
Right.
I actually, I take great pride in that. Yeah, that's, you know, you become an engineer because you like to do things, you like to build things, and you like to invent, and you like to see those things come to fruition, to actually see them produced. It's what you love doing naturally.
Last question, Brian, and then I'll let you go. It's a thing we've done with a bunch of other CEOs we've had on the broadcast, and it goes like this. Tell me what your company does in 5 words or less.
We make everything connected and smart.
We make everything connected and smart. Six, but close. All right, I'll give you that.
Okay.
All right, good. Brian Krzanich, he is the CEO of Intel. Brian, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
You can find all of our corner office interviews and a whole lot more on our Marketplace app on your phone or tablet. You can download it at marketplace.org. Coming up,
it was expected to be a real dud. It was expected to be a children's movie. Even George Lucas himself thought, maybe if I'm lucky, it'll make $12 million.
Oh, if only I could be so wrong. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 238 points today. That is 1.4%, closed at 16,804. The NASDAQ down 71 points, 1.5%, 44.22. The S&P 500 down 26 points, 1.3%, 19.46. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac sank like rocks today. Hedge funds lost their bet that a judge would throw out the mortgage giant's bailout deal, which gives all of their profits to the government. Hence, Fannie off 36% today, Freddie down 37%. Small farm companies working on Ebola treatments got a boost. Techmira Pharmaceuticals gained 17%. Sarepta Therapeutics up 3.7% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.38%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. We'll find out whether you've been shaking things up in the kitchen when McCormick & Company, the spice and flavor people, report earnings. Speaking of kitchens, we'll get weekly mortgage rates from Freddie Mac. And it's the anniversary of one of America's greatest unsuccess stories. On this day in 1950, Charlie Brown and the rest of the Peanuts gang made their comic strip debut. I'm Bridget Bodner.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There's a dust-up in the cable television business that could, the way cable television dust-ups sometimes go, wind up having bigger implications for the way we all get and pay for our TV. Here's the deal. Viacom, the giant media company that owns Comedy Central, Nickelodeon, and MTV, to name just a couple, has been dropped by a smallish cable company out of St. Louis called Suddenlink Communications. Suddenlink says Viacom's shows cost too much and that it can't pass those costs onto its consumers. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman takes it from there.
Here's what you won't hear starting today if you're one of Suddenlink's million or so cable subscribers in states like North Carolina, Arizona, and Texas.
Look, I really think it's time for us to do something. This is all getting way out of hand.
It was almost like he was standing right over her bed talking about the fire. About getting revenge.
Sure, Viacom's channels with South Park and Teen Wolf are pretty popular, says Suddenlink spokesman Pete Abel. But Viacom wanted his cable company to pay nearly 50% more to carry them. Abel says Suddenlink came back with a counterproposal. Let us unbundle your channels. Buy them a la carte. Only a few of the most popular.
Which our customers could then pick, choose, and pay for at their discretion. So far, neither Viacom nor any of the companies have agreed to do that.
Viacom sent us a statement saying this blackout of their stations is Suddenlink's fault. Whoever's to blame, small cable companies dropping networks or dropping out of the TV business altogether, represents a paradigm shift in the industry, says equity analyst Tuna Amobi at S&P Capital IQ.
We've always said that something has got to give, given the escalation in programming costs, which is translating into the cable bills outpacing inflation by orders of magnitude.
Industry analysts say the big media companies are driving ever more of us to cut the cord, finding ways to watch what we want when we want on Hulu, Netflix, and other places where we can log in without paying the cable company. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We've been covering the future of what we currently call television in a series we are calling Screen Wars. And along the way, we've asked a couple of people, what will TV be like in 25 years? You can read what the heads of Amazon Studios, Showtime, and others had to say in response. And you should tell us what you think, too. You can do it all at marketplace.org. A long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. Well, all right, 1977, to be a bit more precise, George Lucas released a little film called Star Wars. At the time, Lucas and more than a couple of big studios weren't expecting it to be more than just another kids' movie. 37 years later, we all know how that has turned out. Star Wars is the most lucrative franchise in the history of film. It is also the topic of Chris Taylor's new book. It's called How Star Wars Conquered the Universe. Chris, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Kyle. It's good to be here.
I want you to start by telling me about your search for somebody who had never seen Star Wars.
It really took until I went to the screening of Star Wars in Navajo out there in Window Rock, Arizona, on the Navajo Reservation.
Navajo, the Navajo language.
The Navajo language. It was the first movie ever to be translated into the Navajo language. And I went out there to try and find anyone among the elders of the Navajo tribe who actually hadn't seen this movie. And it was quite a difficult process. Then I found one elder, a guy who was a code talker from World War II. Not only had he never seen the movie, he didn't even know what the title meant. He wondered if the stars were at war. And we had a long conversation, and finally, just before the movie started, he said, "I saw wild birds in space once. It was on TV somewhere, maybe." And I sort of held my arms up and down at 45 degrees, and he was like, "Yeah, yeah, they look like that." And I realized he was talking about X-Wing fighters. So even this guy, who had no TV, lives in the mountains, even he had something of Star Wars in his brain.
And this is a movie that was basically dropped by United Artists and Universal. 20th Century Fox almost got rid of it. I mean, this thing came close, we could say, to not even being made.
It really did. It was expected to be a real dud. It was expected to be a children's movie. Even George Lucas himself thought, oh, I've just made this little children's movie and maybe if I'm lucky, it'll make $12 million, which was what the average Disney movie was making at the time. And maybe if we're lucky, we might make our money back on the toys. And of course, he had no idea what he was in for.
The number I think that you say in this book is $35 to $40 billion over 35 years, something like
That's correct. I mean, Lucasfilm is an intensely private company, and now it's an intensely private subsidiary of Disney. The best estimate that we have is that $32 billion has been sold at retail in terms of merchandising. And then on top of that, you add the ticket sales, which is roughly $4 billion. And then you add the home video, DVD, Blu-ray, etc. That's about $6 billion. So we're looking at roughly $42 billion overall.
It is basically fact, you say.
Yes.
That George Lucas wound up having to keep on making these movies because they were cash cows and he needed to run a business, by God.
Well, he did try to drop Star Wars several times, and he has described the process of it reaching out and grabbing him and slamming him against a wall, and that it took him an awful long time to come to terms with the fact that it was within him and the full story had to get out. But yeah, he did. He stated publicly after Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith, which was the last of the six movies, that there were going to be no more. He hadn't even written any. So when he turned around in 2012 and told his company, hey, you know, we're going to start making Episode 7, 8, and 9, that was quite surprising to a lot of people because, of course, we've been told these didn't exist all along.
All right, last thing, and then I'll let you get on your way. And this is for the fanboys out there, obviously. Han shot first, right?
Han did shoot first. The Greedo shot was moved forward 11 frames in the Blu-ray edition so that they now appear to be shooting at the same time.
Scandalous. Chris Taylor is the deputy editor at Mashable. His book is called How Star Wars Conquered the Universe. Chris, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Kai. It was a pleasure.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which the phrase planetary defense features prominently from the Wall Street Journal, this item. The U.S. has apparently fallen behind on its timeline for getting rid of old nuclear weapons. One reason the administration is hanging onto them, according to the GAO, disposition is pending, and this is a quote, senior-level government evaluation of their use in planetary defense against Earth-bound asteroids. I personally feel much better now. You guys? All right, we're done. That is the show for today. The Dow off 238 points, 1.4%. The NASDAQ down 71 points, 1.5%. The S&P 500 dropped 26 points, 1.3%. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.